Where in London in 2006 can you find a theatre from the 16th century? Well, it's a trick question. The building I'm standing in front of has a thatched roof and is built using technology that's a good half millennium old. This place is actually newer than you'd think. It's certainly newer than the swish penthouse apartments and she-she office blocks that loom over it. I'm talking, of course, about the Globe Theatre on London's Bankside, where I'm standing right now. For all that this place opened just under a decade ago, it's an amazingly faithful replica of the theatre built by Shakespeare and his colleagues in 1599, faithful down to the last piece of plaster and chunk of Renaissance carving. At the moment, at the Globe, it's all change. The founding artistic director, Mark Rylance, has moved on after 10 years at the helm, and his successor, Dominic Dromgoole, has just taken up the post. Right now, in late April, it's a busy time here. Shakespeare's 442nd birthday is being celebrated this weekend, and, more crucially, the new summer season is just around the corner. Inside the theatre right now, behind the riverside gates and the tourists munching ice cream on the bankside, buttons are being sewn on, music is being rehearsed, and actors are practising fight scenes, and of course, trying desperately to remember their lines. So, we at Guardian Unlimited thought that we'd go and get under everyone's feet. I've dragged Dominic out of rehearsals, and he's promised to give us an exclusive behind-the-scenes tour of the theatre and its history. He'll also be offering us a sneak preview of what he and the Globe Company have got coming up later this summer. So, time to go inside and say hello. Dominic, excellent
hello.
To meet you.
How are you?
Very good, thank you. You're going to take us on a tour around the theatre?
Yes, let's go up to the top of the theatre and we'll have a look from there.
Okay, we've come inside the building and we've climbed up the stairs all the way to the top. It's a bit like a big donut, the Globe, really, in a funny kind of way. You've got three tiers of seating and the thatch roof above, all in one big circle. And then beneath that, you have an open area, which is called the Yard, where people stand for performances in the summer, just as they would have done during Shakespeare's time as well. I guess it seems quite a good place to talk about the history of this reconstruction. Dominic, who first came up with the idea of rebuilding an Elizabethan theatre on the banks of the Thames?
It started sort of in 1949 when Sam Wanamaker, who was potentially one of the McCarthyite blacklist of American actors, was volunteered to disappear from his own country before he was exiled. And he came over here and he was a Jewish firebrand, intellectually heavyweight actor. And he was mad keen on Shakespeare and passionate about Shakespeare. And he came to England, and one of the first places he headed for was the Globe, and he thought there would be a Globe. And he came down to Bankside, and he found nothing at all, apart from a lot of sort of bombed-out rubble, and a small plaque, I think, on a pub, saying that the Globe had once been there. And so, from that moment, he sort of dedicated his life to trying to get this built. He was a very canny soul, and so in the late 60s, before anybody thought the Bankside would be anything but one of London's no-go areas, a sort of dustbin of history, he could see that there was commercial potential here, and so he bought up a certain amount of land in the area, which made him a player. And at the same time as he was doing that, some very heavyweight property companies were buying into the area as well. And so he had these enormous financial corporations buying in, and one man. Then there was a massive series of battles with the local council. There was huge battles with the rest of the theatre world that said it was a silly idea, that it was some sort of Disneyfying heritage nonsense, and there was an ongoing battle to raise the money. And Sam Wanamaker was an extraordinary fundraiser, and almost every single person he met he sort of managed to get £5, £10, £100, £1,000, £10,000 out of, and somehow he pulled together enough money to raise this place. The saddest part of the story, in a way, is that after 45 years of monumental effort to get it done, just at the moment when they were deciding what their priorities should be in rebuilding it, he said that their priority should be to build the Underglobe first, so that would be an exhibition area that could fund the rest of the place. And he made that decision knowing that he only had a year to live. So they built the Underglobe, and then he died just before they started building the Globe itself. So he never saw anything but the foundations for the theatre that he'd given his whole life to create.
And if Sam had lived, what would he have seen being raised on this spot?
he would have seen the building we're in, which I think is an extraordinary building. You walk towards it, you come from over the Millennium Bridge on the other side, and it looks tiny, this sort of small furry thing tucked into the armpit of Tate Modern, which is this great looming 1930s red brick monster. And you think, God, is that the Globe? It's a bit bijou, isn't it? And then for some reason, because of the shape of it, you come in here and you feel like you're in somewhere immense. You feel like you're in somewhere as big as the world. Because of the roundness of it, because of the height of it, because you see nothing but the sky above you. You feel like you're in something that could encompass anywhere. So it's got a sort of peculiar TARDIS effect. He would have seen, if he was here, Sam Wanamaker, the only thatched roof in London since 1665, for very obvious reasons. He'd see a tremendous amount of very Rococo paintwork on the stage itself and on the roof above the stage. The rest of the theatre is quite plain white and wood. An Elizabethan person would have looked at the stage and said, yes, that's just about right. Looking at a lot of mythical figures were painted in and a lot of detail and a lot of colour. They would have said, that's just about right. And then he would have turned around and looked at the theatre and said, why are you putting plays on in this miserable old barn? Because for them, colour and decoration was everything. And I think as time goes on and as money comes in, the colour and excitement of the stage will slowly extend around the auditorium.
And that's amazing, isn't it? It's like the building keeps on changing with time. It's sort of alive.
Yes, that's very, very true. That's very true. I think that it's important that the Globe retains a capacity to surprise. I think that the reason people came here in the beginning was that they were so amazed by how different it was and how strange it was and how extraordinary it was. And I think that we have a continual role in maintaining that level of surprise by continuing to sort of add in details and change things. And there's a huge number of other things that will happen over the years, just so that every year when people come back, there'll be something new for them. This year we're going to have a roof, which will be something of a surprise.
A roof over the entire structure?
It's going to be fantastic, actually. It's Titus Andronicus has got a wonderful designer called Bill Dudley, who's one of the great designers in the last 50 years. And he's putting a velarium on. The velariums were the Roman temporary roof structures that they put over things like the Colosseum, which is made out of rope and fabric. So it's something we'll be able to put up and take down show by show. But it should make for a very different atmosphere.
This is really exciting. We've walked down the stairs and we're now standing inside the very heart of the theatre. This room we're in, it's called the Tiring Room. Tiring is short for attiring, which is to say it's the kind of dressing room space where the actors do their quick changes and store props and things like that. I guess the big surprise is that it is immediately behind the stage. You have a big double door in the centre, two smaller doors either side, all of them open directly onto the stage. Dominic, this is totally empty at the moment, but I guess when the season starts it'll be completely jam full of stuff, won't it?
It'll be absolutely stuffed. The back wall of the Tiring House would have been the back wall of the theatre in days gone by, so the actors would have come in out of the street into here and got dressed in here. I mean, nowadays we've got sort of proper modern dressing rooms or whatever. But during the course of a show, this place is, it's sort of rather fantastic, actually. I had an evening here last year, and it's rather beautiful, it's rather frantic. There's probably about 15 to 20 people in here, 10 actors or more at any one moment, 3 or 4 stage management, 5 or 6 dressers, all crammed into this tiny space, and with a very frenetic amount of things to do and get done in terms of props and costumes, all in quiet. But it's chaos. And then they walk with complete calm and complete aplomb out into the stage beyond. It's terrific. I remember seeing Mark Rylance coming off very relaxed, came through the door, then he rushed to the corner to get changed, and 3 or 4 dressers attacked him with their fingers and undid all of his buttons and unlaced all of his bits and pieces and whatever and took his shoes off. And it was a wonderful sight, took everything off and then redressed him in a completely different way, all within about 2 minutes. And so he came off as one marvellous Renaissance creation and went back on as another.
What kind of things would we expect to see costumes-wise back here?
Well, there's a tradition here of doing authentic Elizabethan costumes, not exclusively. Sometimes things are in modern dress, sometimes things are in abstract dress. This particular year, because we're doing a series of Roman plays, we're doing Coriolanus and Titus Andronicus and Antony and Cleo, we are doing a sort of mixture of Elizabethan clothing and the Elizabethan's idea of what Roman clothing would be. But, you know, because you've got no set, you've got no lighting, you've got no sound, the two sort of essential elements through which you express the production are costume, which sort of creates the world, and music, which sort of helps you shape the narrative and helps you drive the evening along. So there's always live musicians here, and there's always quite extraordinary costumes, because they essentially are the set.
And always the most wonderful thing, it strikes me, about this space as well, is that you can imagine Shakespeare kind of pacing around backstage almost. There is a sense of that everything in this building is kind of organic, isn't it? It's all connected.
You come with me and I'll show you something, which is, because when I was here last year for Measure for Measure, I spent much of the evening backstage watching the mechanics backstage, but I also like to watch the stage. So I'm coming over to a side door now, which is one of the two side doors, and there's a small grill in it, a small hole in it with a little metal grill in, through which you can see what's going on stage and you can see the audience beyond. And it was a fantastic moment looking through there. It was a wonderful summer's evening. The audience were very high and happy. And looking through here, you could see the backs of the actors. And beyond that, you could see 1,500 very bright, very excited, very sort of gleaming faces pouring energy back in at them. And then I thought afterwards, what a sort of Shakespearean place this particular spot is, because Shakespeare was a bit part actor, and he would have spent a lot of time waiting to go on, or having just come off, having played his ghost in Hamlet, or whatever the small parts that we sort of suspect he played. And he would have looked through here, and he would have heard his own plays, and he would have heard, you know, what worked, and whether a gag worked, or whether a particularly lyric moment sort of caught the breath of the audience, or whether a particularly tragic moment shut them up. And he would have watched and listened and watched and listened, and every time he would have refined his technique, and he would have worked out how to do it better than the time before.
Seems a good point as any to go out onto the stage yourself. Never thought I'd find myself on the stage of the Globe, but we've come out through the stage doors and here we are, and it is amazing, I have to say. It's like being on the prow of a ship. You're surrounded, totally enveloped by the building, the tiers of seats, then the thatched roof above, all in a big circle. If I look directly up, I can see this beautiful coloured canopy painted with the signs of the zodiac. There are these enormous two pillars either side of the stage, wooden again, but painted to look like marble. Dominic, this must be just such a different experience performing here, totally different to a modern theatre.
Completely different. It's much livelier, it's much more urgent, it's much more alert, largely because you've got 600 people standing, and the energy they bring is the energy of standing people rather than sitting people, because if you're standing, you are alert and you're alive. Also, the seats aren't the greatest seats in the world. The shame of that is that it's bad for people's backs. The advantage is that people have to sit up. And the experience of going to the theatre is a sitting-up experience. So because you've got all of this liveliness and excitement coming at you, it's a very, very intelligent room. It's probably the most intelligent room I've ever been in, which is why I think Shakespeare's verse and his wit works so well in here. Where often you find yourself falling asleep at it, or certainly not finding it funny. Here, the wit is very alive, because you've got all of these minds keying into it and trying to make it work for them. So that's fantastic. It creates a fantastic, very bubbly atmosphere, much more like a comedy gig or a rock concert than a theatre. The audience are lit. I mean, they're lit by daylight during the day, obviously, but in the evening, when the light comes up on the stage, the light also comes up on the audience, because the whole idea is you can see them all the time, and it's a shared activity.
And what's it like for actors performing in this space?
For actors, it's a funny mix of terrifying before they come on. So they stand back there, especially their first performances, absolutely cacking their pants, terrified of what it might bring. But then the moment they do come on, I'm told, they find a very sort of warm embrace around them, and they find themselves very looked after and very loved and very listened to and very engaged with. So it's a funny mixture of being, you know, absolutely shit-scaring when they're off, and then when they're in, they never want to leave again.
And I guess it's different too, because the audience is so much in control, they've got so much power here.
Yes, it is. No, it's absolutely not like any other theatre at all. Because the groundlings are there, they're quite mobile, they're quite antsy, they move about a bit, they can cough, they love to laugh, they like to get engaged in some way. A lot of people find that very hard. They think that's a sort of crime, they think that's not what a theatre audience should be. They think theatre audiences should be inert and passive and silent. But that certainly wasn't the Elizabethan way, and it's not the way of this theatre. And I think that once people have tasted the experience here, they sort of realise that it's closer to what theatre's meant to be than going into a large, well-appointed, modern theatre space with lots of sort of very plush armchairs that you sit in and then you fall asleep.
And it has that very specific dynamic in terms of Shakespeare's plays, doesn't it? Because the first play you're opening with this season is Coriolanus, which is a play full of crowd scenes and baying people, and, you know, it has a very strong, aggressive dynamic.
You know, the class structures and the class war that's at the heart of Coriolanus is easy to play in here, because you've got the crowd there and you've got the crowd at the actors' feet. So a lot of the citizens will be in the in amongst the yard, in amongst the groundlings. There was a very funny thing Mark Rylance said the other day about how he went to see Coriolanus at the Old Vic, and at one point Coriolanus had to address the crowd, and, you know, in front of him he had 1,000 people at the Old Vic, but instead of actually addressing them, he turned rather awkwardly, looked upstage, and addressed three actors who were sort of 10 yards ahead of him on the other side of the stage. And it's a sort of madness of modern theatre that when you've got the crowd there, you don't address them or you ignore them. And that's something here that it's an asset we've got and we intend to use, certainly with Coriolanus.
So there's going to be Coriolanus. What else are we going to see this summer?
Titus Andronicus, which has got the roof on, and which is a fantastic sort of macabre apprentice work, full of the sort of gleeful shock horror invention of a young playwright who's sort of playing at anything you can do, I can do better game with Thomas Kidd and Christopher Marlowe and Webster. It's great, it's nonsense, and it's fantastic nonsense, and very, very shattering in its own way as well. We're doing that, and then we're doing the greatest love story of all time, Antony and Cleopatra, which also has a Roman flavour, so there's a sort of Roman flavour running through the whole year.
That's fantastic, thank you very much indeed, and look forward to seeing the season open.
It was a pleasure, thank you, very nice to meet you.
So there you have it, a whistle-stop tour around Shakespeare's Globe. Not quite as good as visiting the real thing, but you can do that yourself from the 5th of May, which is when Dominic will be back right here directing his production of Coriolanus. Later in the season, there's Titus Andronicus, which is from the 20th of May, and Antony and Cleopatra will open a month later, on the 25th of June. We'll be covering the lot here on Guardian Unlimited, so make sure you check back for all the latest theatre reviews, recommendations and features. You can find us at arts.guardian.co.uk.